My almost died story is we're sitting there in like this 6 to 8 foot zone, and then out of nowhere, this 12 to 15 foot wave set comes through. I am comfortable like 4 to 8 foot waves. 8 foot's like kind of a little bit uncomfortable, but like I can deal with that. If you're in a bad spot, the wave's just going to break on you and it's going to take you under and it's going to pin you down. A wave can come through, but if it's not going to crash on you, you're just going to go up and down. Like it can roll with you, but if the wave starts turning over on you and you're underneath of it, there's nowhere to go. Like it's going to crash on you, pin you down and pull you. I had to learn a lot about how to stay alive in the water. I'm Kurt Benkert, and this is Pocket Presence, powered by Sleeper. We're back, baby. We are back. Another wonderful episode of Pocket Presence. It's been 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. The first break that I've taken, Tyler, since starting everything post-NFL. And it was much needed. It was awesome. I encourage people to take breaks now. Didn't know they were so great. I traveled around the country, or I traveled around the world for the first time ever. Yeah. I've never left the country. It was wild. So I'm happy to be back.
Dude. We're happy to have you back. You obviously missed the draft, and I'm curious to hear about your experience of like going off the grid. It looked like you caught the first couple of rounds, but then you come back and the entire landscape of the NFL is different. We worked all this time leading up to the draft, talking about all these hypotheticals, and then it happens when you're off the grid and you come back, and I'm sure you're just hit with a wall of news and information that we're going to begin to unwind a little bit here. But I mean, first tell us about this trip, because you sent that a tweet with the screenshot where you were just on the other side of the world. I thought was hilarious. And then, we went into round one of the draft and it was like, we'll just catch up with Kurt when he gets back. So how was it?
Yeah, honestly, it was a life-changing trip, and I'm not one to like use that lightly. I'll give the whole premise of the trip and I'll do a little storytelling and just kind of how it all happened. So for those of you that don't know, I moved to Maui with my wife and daughter. We went on an extended trip when I broke my ribs in the XFL. And that was like I need to get out of here. I need to just like walk away from football. And I need to like legitimately remove myself from normal life and just go like, let's just go experience. So we go to Maui. We're there for a long time. And I meet a bunch of friends that are going to be lifelong friends. One of them is, his name is Garrett G. He runs the Bucket List Family on Instagram, YouTube. Like it's kind of their thing. And if you guys like know National Geographic, like they just recently published a book with them. So Garrett texted me a couple months ago and was like, hey, I'm getting a bunch of my close guy friends together to see who wants to go on this trip. It's going to be the trip of a lifetime, guys trip. It's in Indonesia. We'll be surfing sun up to sundown and we'll be living on a boat the entire time. And I was like, well, I've never left the country. I've never really left my family like that. I've never been able to not talk to people. And when we were on this, like fast forward, I said yes. But on this trip, you won't have service a lot of the time. For me, it was a 12-hour time difference from my family. So like as I was going to bed, they were waking up and vice versa. Like we got like these smidgens of like fractions of a day to talk if we even had service at all some days. So I go with my friend Garrett, a bunch of other friends from Maui. One of my friends, Kyle, he does a lot of stuff on Instagram and stuff too, and like the pro metabolic world. So this group of very health conscious, like individuals, we all go and we travel around the world. I go from Florida to Dallas, to Maui, to Honolulu, Tokyo, which was Tokyo Airport, by the way, the one that I went to was phenomenal. Mm. I have a whole new respect for Japanese culture. Bidets, life-changing. First ever bidet use, by the way.
Oh, really?
A great story about that. Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely get into the bidet story, but I have a bidet now that I just bought for my house. So like I'm locked in.
You were like a full convert using a bidet once.
Dude, quickly. I mean, I'm going to single-handedly take down big toilet paper. but then we go from Tokyo to Jakarta, which Jakarta is a spot in Indonesia. Jakarta to Padang, I think is how you say it. And then we took a boat from a harbor in Padang to the Mentawais. And so if you were into like surf culture, the Mentawais are like this coveted surf region where the water is warm. It's like deep blue. There's not really like, we didn't see any sharks, but like it's a lot of coral. you have to take boat from like spot to spot to spot. And so we took a 12-hour boat ride once we got there to the original spot. And then we just went up and down the coastline for the Mentawai's the entire trip. And then we came back. But for me, it was 10, 12 hours, 20 hours, 28 hours. It was like 35 to 40 hours of like air travel. Wow. And then the 12-hour boat ride one way. So like it was over 100 hours of travel in this 2-week stretch, which was wild. And the coolest part was like I started reading again, and I haven't read since I was a kid. So like I haven't consistently read since I was a kid. And it was just like a really nice forced disconnect from everything I've been working on for years, and with a lot of really cool experience along the way.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds incredible. It sounds like maybe a purposely hard place to get to. I mean, you talk about it's a coveted surf spot. Is it like known in surf culture as the place to go? Like are the waves better? Are the, you know, like the water, you said the water's warmer.
Yeah, the waves are better. The waves are consistent. There's different breaks for different, like different surf breaks for different skill levels. Like, and I was the worst surfer on the trip. Like these guys have been surfing for a long time. And also like I'm a bigger body type. So like surfing, it's just, once you're over 200 pounds, it's just harder. But like the guys that are like 150, 145, 170, like that's like easier to surf. You can use a smaller board. But yeah, the place was insane. And like, I actually think there was someone that wrote a book about it, that this place really wasn't like popular 10 to 15 years ago, like 20 years ago. Prior to that, like it really was like undiscovered and like not heavily traveled. And now there's like charters and like all, like everything's like built around people being able to go experience these surf trips there. But yeah, dude, we lived on a boat for like 10 days. We ate every meal on the boat. I got my first bout of seasickness ever, which was wild. I read a couple books throughout that span. Like it was so like good for the soul in general, and also pushed me to like the limits of who I thought I could be as a human.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was just, I'm not like, I didn't grow up a swimmer. Like I didn't grow up like swimming in the water. I grew up fishing, and I never left the boat because we caught sharks. And like, that was just kind of like how I looked at the open water. And so I faced a lot of fear of like being in the middle of an ocean, in the middle of nowhere, in the open water, sitting on a board. And I know Roddy put in our notes, the almost died story there in surfing. Like I am comfortable like 4 to 8 foot waves. Like that's like 8 foot's like kind of a little bit uncomfortable, but like I can deal with that. I had a few experiences on this trip where a random set came through from the middle of the ocean with these monster waves that if you're in a bad spot, the wave's just going to break on you and it's going to take you under and it's going to pin you down. And that happened a few too many times for my comfort level of being in the water. So that's my almost died story is I'm sitting there. My friend Garrett, who is like a pretty good surfer, we're sitting there in like this 6 to 8 foot zone. And then out of nowhere, this 12 to 15 foot wave set comes through. And when a wave can come through, but if it's not going to crash on you, you're just going to go up and down. Like it can roll with you. But if the wave starts turning over on you and you're underneath of it, there's nowhere to go. Like it's going to crash on you, pin you down and pull you. And I had to learn a lot about how to stay alive in the water while you're like you just don't realize how powerful waves are. So it was just wild.
So what makes you want to go on a trip like this? You talk about the worst surfer in the group.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of the draft. You know, your job is now built around like NFL media. It's 100 hours of travel. A lot of reasons to say no. Why did you say yes?
Honestly, I felt like it was like what I needed in life more than anything. Like I have, like there were definitely, like you said, a lot of reasons to say no. And for me, it was just one of those things. Like, I'm not even going to think about this. I'm just going to say yes and go with it. And we're going to see what good comes out of it. And so much more good came out of it than I could have ever imagined. Like just, I don't know. I've never disconnected before. And I think physically removing myself to a place that I had no choice but to disconnect allowed me to have new appreciation for everything, for like myself, for my wife, my daughter, like the amount of time I dedicate to work. Like it, I just realized that taking a step back and removing yourself from not being connected to the phone, like I am all the time for the work that I do, it allowed me to like take some things from that trip and feel like I can integrate it back into my own life day to day that I feel like will make me more efficient, like more present. And I think that's the biggest thing for me. I really struggle being present when I feel like there's something that I need to do or something that's not done or I could be doing productive wise. And like, it's just, I don't know. I definitely encourage people to find a way to disconnect, because I think disconnecting allows you to be present more often, but it's not just like a day thing. Mm-hmm. Like if I had went off grid for a day, I don't think that would have done it for me. Like I had to feel what boredom feels like. And I picked up a book, like instead of just the instant gratification of a notification or this and that. And especially in the work that we do, like I could refresh all day long and there'll be something new. Like there'll be a new notification, new follow, new something, whatever. And so for me, I'm like, I want to take as much of that trip, bottle it up and put that in my pocket for like my day-to-day life.
I love that. What's the first thing you did once you got back, full access to your phone? And then once you got back to your home and like back to a proper schedule?
Yeah. So I FaceTimed my wife as soon as I could. And then the funniest thing is I actually did not look at my phone for 2 days. And I knew I had a bunch of texts. I knew like there was just a never ending whatever to catch up with. But like if I go to screen time, like I did not respond to that stuff. Like you can see my screen time in the last whatever, 3 days.
Yeah.
Like compared to what it was when I was traveling, and like the travel days, like I was on my phone the whole time catching up. But like, as soon as I got home, it was just funny. Like I had no urge to like want to feel like I need to know what's going on. Like I didn't have FOMO, and I thought that would be the biggest thing, especially with the draft. Yeah. Like you and I have worked months to get all this draft stuff ready and prepped and whatever. And then as soon as I like was able to disconnect, I'm like, well, it's out there. It's done. Like I did the work. Hopefully people loved it and the news is going to happen. I'm going to be able to catch up, and it definitely makes me want to like bulk or batch things more often than not, in my process, like day to day. So yeah, just a lot of really good things to learn on that trip for myself personally, from some of the books that I read. And then even just like seeing how different cultures live, like Padang was just like, I don't think it's considered third world, but like I have no reference of anything but the United States. And like, it was just crazy how little people had, and I've never seen people so happy. And it was just like this light bulb went off of like, they have like a handful of things to their name and they are just happy to be there and they're present. And I'm like, holy shit. Like I have a lot in life. And the biggest thing I have struggled with is being present. So for me, that's like, it was just, there's just so many like little light bulbs and like wins in that aspect of traveling. So,
yeah. And I can imagine too, it's a great reset and recentering of what this work means. It seems like we get caught in thinking that we have to be the first to stuff. That's just how the media landscape seems to be now. Mm-hmm. You know, my North Star, we've never talked about this publicly, but I know you and I have talked about on the side, like my North Star is that I don't have to be competing with people on being the fastest or being the most sensationalized, because there is so much of that out there. And I think it's a race to the bottom. I imagine this trip for you is a great recentering of like, look, I can come back and do good work and people will appreciate the good work when I get to it. But until then, I'm not going to put myself through so much and maybe sacrifice a lot of long-term benefits for the short-term gratification of being the first to something. Yeah. I can imagine you come back to this, and as we cover the draft now, 2 weeks later, it's like, we're going to put in the work. You're going to put in the work to have really good analysis. Once we get to the season, of course, we'll be up to speed on a lot of things. But at the end of the day, it's a great reminder that like our North Star here isn't to be the fastest, most sensationalized, most clickbaity. It's to do the best work, and hopefully people can come to that work and appreciate it when the time is right for them, just like we're getting it to it when the time is right for us.
And you know, that is a great point. Like for the viewer, for the people that watch, like the comments that make me the happiest are like, finally got to this at my lunch break, finally got to this like after a few days, like really love the work you guys put into this. I can tell you like those things for me are so much more satisfying when I know someone like deliberately went to go find it and catch up than they got clickbaited or like, you know what I mean? Like that, that is a never ending battle. And I know that people have a lot of success about it, but like, I don't want my success to be determined by what went viral.
Right.
I think viral videos are great. But like seeing some of the videos from when we're gone, like 10,000 views, 20, 30, whatever. And then out of nowhere, 300,000 views come through because it went viral. It's like, that feels better than, oh, they just did something crazy. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's like a real sustainable version of like, we won't get burnt out doing that. Like, the people around us appreciate the content and the work that we put in. The people are like waiting for the quality, and like, they, I want that to be what they know they get from us. And this trip was just such a good reminder of like, look, it's not about the quantity. It's not about like how fast. It's about what words are we saying based on our like analysis, what we think, and like how much time and effort, like a mental effort we put into it. Because again, it's a rat race and there's a lot of people in media. There's a lot of things going on in media. And I just want to be this show that people can know, like, hey, let's take a deep breath when we listen to Kurt and Tyler talk about football, because this is going to be more conversational and more analytical than what we just get these fast breaking news, blah, 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 whatever. And all that other stuff.
I think you're exactly right.
Most of you guys already use Sleeper for your fantasy sports leagues. I do too. But Sleeper Picks is a whole other side of the operation that is growing fast. Sleeper Picks is now operational in over 25 different states, and playing the games are simple. You go grab a few player props that you like for that night. You pick over and under, whether it be assists, touchdowns, interceptions, rebounds, goals, whatever sport, it doesn't matter. They got a lot available. You add them to an entry. You can win up to 100 times your money for whatever you put in. And the best part is Sleeper is now matching your first time deposit up to $500 when you type in Kurt at checkout. I'll see you there.
Well, I don't mean to put the daunting task in front of us, but you did miss quite a bit. And I think our audience wants us to catch up and talk about football as much as we could philosophize all day. Let's just run through a quick hitting draft recap. I want to talk about some things that ended up shaking out. Really the first, you know, up until the Atlanta pick with Penix, it was pretty chalky. You know, there weren't any trades up. There wasn't anything that went crazy. I think for all the mock drafts that we saw, they were pretty stock and standard. So we'll talk here first about Jaden Daniels to Washington.
Yep.
He's your guy. Dan Quinn now has his guy. It's kind of a fun young team. How do you see Daniels working in Washington, especially in this first year?
Yeah, I think Jaden Daniels is going to be a stud. And I think we said something earlier, or I said something earlier a couple of weeks ago about Dan Quinn. If I know anything about Dan Quinn, Jaden Daniels is a Dan Quinn kind of guy. Like, he's going to love him. And people are like, oh no, like they're taking Drake May. This, like, that's whatever. Like, Dan Quinn is going to thrive with a guy like Jaden Daniels at quarterback with how he plays. And Jaden Daniels is going to thrive with a coach like Dan Quinn that leads the way he does. The way that Dan Quinn leads his teams and the way that he operates the entire organization, like, I think that they have the pieces in place. And also with Adam Peters, their GM, like, I'm so excited to see if this Commanders team and organization can flip this division. Because of all of the divisions that feel like there's top dogs, like the Cowboys and the Eagles, I think the Commanders are one of the dark horses that could be like the Texans, that are just like, nah, we're here. Like, you think you're here, but like, we're actually here. And you're going to have to deal with us for a long time. And that's what happens when you get a guy like Jaden Daniels. If he could stay healthy, he's already got talented receivers around him. Like, Sam Howell was able to throw the shit out of the ball last year. Threw for a lot of yards, just turned the ball over a lot. And he even, like, Sam Howell scrambled a bunch. He had a lot of rushing touchdowns. And Sam Howell is nowhere near the guy that Jaden Daniels is with his feet. So the core of what they have, man, I'm excited. And they're in year one. The best thing about this, they get a rookie quarterback on a rookie deal with a head coach and a GM that are in year one of their contracts. They have time to get this thing right. And they don't have to be successful this year. But I think they will. I think they're going to have some really, like, good marginal wins this year. And they could be a weird wild card team.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting parts of the draft, especially when you get the run of quarterbacks like we had, is we now start to group these guys together and then compare them to one another. And really, once they're out of the draft class, it doesn't matter how they stack up against each other. They're being thrown into the pool of all NFL quarterbacks. But I do think, whether it be between Caleb, Jaden, and probably more Jaden and Drake May, there's going to be some interesting comparisons here. Talk a little bit about the situation that Jaden Daniels is now in with Cliff Kingsbury as his OC and Dan Quinn as his head coach, and Drake May, who I don't even know who the Patriots OC is, and they have a first year unproven head coach. Like, talk about the difference of those situations and the importance as it pertains to their rookie year.
Yeah. So I do not want to hold Drake May accountable for anything that happens in his career with the Patriots until at least year five. Like, I have a really hard time with this Drake May situation, because you're putting a guy in a Sam Darnold situation, and that just is what it is. You drafted a guy because you need a quarterback, but like, your team's not ready to have that quarterback, and you're going to waste a few good valuable years of his life and in this rebuild. And not to mention, like, you just look at the landscape of the AFC East. It's not like you're in this vacuum of being a New England Patriot. you're in the AFC East with Aaron Rodgers, who's coming back off of injury, with Tua, who, like, I'm not the highest on Tua, but Tua's going to win games with them, and they have a studded, they have a star team. Like, their team is insane. And then you have Josh Allen and the Bills, and, like, where are you going to get your wins? Those three teams could sweep you entirely this year. And I do think that Mayo's a good defensive coach. I think that the Patriots defense is going to be good. They're always decent. And I don't think Bill Belichick is necessarily needed for that. But, like, I don't see how they flip that division. That division is something else. And so I look at them compared to Jaden Daniels and their situation, like, Drake May, like, save this clip. He's probably going to be on a different team in 3 years because shit just didn't work out. And they ended up getting another top five draft pick, and they're going to go draft somebody else that's like the new hot thing or whatever. And Drake May is going to be in a Trey Lance type of situation. That's how I look at it. And it's not, and I love Trey Lance. Trey Lance didn't deserve that. It just happened to work out with Brock Purdy. But for Drake May, it's like, what is that path? Like, what is the path to success? Drake May has the hardest path to success out of any quarterback in this draft, and it's not even close. And I don't even know if you threw Josh Allen on the Patriots, would they be a good team this year? They'd be better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, like, yeah. What are we actually thinking here? Because I could have seen a lot of different things that the Patriots need before a quarterback. And the thing is, a quarterback needs other players around him to play well. I don't give a shit who it is. Like, I don't care. Patrick Mahomes would not be Patrick Mahomes if he didn't have Travis Kelce's entire career, Tyreek Hill most of his career, and he had a really good run game last year with a top five defense. Like, Patrick Mahomes would not save the New England Patriots this year. Drake May is not going to be able to do it. And I don't think he should be asked to do it, honestly.
Yeah, I think you saw two differences in theories when it came to the Giants drafts, because a lot of people were thinking they could move up and get a quarterback. But you look at the roster the same way you look at the Patriots roster, and you think, like, they are not just a quarterback away. And that's assuming that Drake May is the guy and will hit. We're not even sure about
exactly.
That. They're not, you know, the Giants are a quarterback away. So let's build out, you know, they want wide receiver, but you could have seen them build out the O-line, build out the defense, because this is a multi-year rebuild. And I think you're right. You're probably going to waste valuable years, both in Drake May's career, but also in having a guy on a rookie deal. Like, if Drake May does turn out to be the guy, well, shit, you got to pay him in 3 or 4 years
Exactly. And then you're, it's terrible business, dude. Yeah. It's terrible business. And shit, man, I'm looking at it this way. Is Drake May going to be there in 10 years? Like, someone tell me, what are the chances Drake May is going to be a New England Patriot in 10 years? Like, I don't know. Probably not. Like, I don't think so. Joe Alt had the best chance, and, like, yeah, you'd be considered reaching for a tackle there, but, like, that's the type of player that you get for the next 10 years. Like a Jake Matthews type of like a tackle that the Falcons have. Like, you're in such a deep rebuild. You suck as an organization right now, and you have to look around you. You have to be self-aware as an organization and see, yeah, like, we want to compete this year. We want to go get that guy, but, like, look at the teams we have to play twice a year. There's 6 games in a season. And how do we stack up roster for roster versus each 3 of those teams? Is this quarterback going to change this for us? No. Like, no, it's not. So go get somebody that's going to change things for you right now. Because at the end of the day, the only ones in that division that, like, have some sort of question mark is the Jets, because Aaron's older. Like, he's probably got 2 more years or so to play. Like, so you're up against way more than just yourselves and your roster. So is the GM going to outlive Drake May's contract as the head coach? Like, I know that Mayo, like, it was the right thing to do to take the job, his first head coach job back where he was coaching. But, like, dude, you look at Vrabel. Vrabel took a job with the Titans and did a decent job and got fired. Like, coaches get fired. The rookie first year stuff is going to be over next year, and they're going to be in year 2.
Yeah.
That's how I like to think of all these things. After you suck this year, what are you going to be looked at next year? If you suck again, you're out. So then you're in the Chicago Bears cycle where Drake May is going to go into year 3 of his contract if they suck the next 2 years with a new head coach, a new GM or whatever. And then what? Then they're going to come in and they're going to get their guy. It's just, you set yourself up for such a bad cycle if you do what they did. And you have to get lucky to get out of that. Like, that's, if this works for them, it's going to be a lot to do with luck and things falling their way.
Yeah, I completely,
in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree. Everything in the draft, pretty chalky, like we said, until pick 8. Every mock draft we'd ever seen, I'm sure our mock draft, even had the Falcons taking Dallas Turner, edge rusher. And then they, I mean, the biggest shock of the draft, we thought it might come in a trade up or, you know, a quarterback falling to some, but it was Michael Penix at number 8.
Yeah.
A lot of people are obviously very critical of this move. A lot of reports came out after the fact that Kirk Cousins wasn't consulted. I saw a report recently that part of the reason Kirk Cousins left Minnesota was because of their focus on drafting a quarterback to come in behind him. He didn't want them to do that. It seemed like this was a shock to everybody, including their owner. I mean, there's that clip that was going viral. I don't know if you saw it, where it looked like Fontenot, the GM was explaining to Arthur Blank the move, and we don't know if that's what was happening, but it was funny to assume that was what was happening. A lot of negative things about this pick, Kurt, but I get the sense from you that you're a little higher on it than most people are. Can you explain why?
So I think I said right before the draft that there were teams that I looked at that I'm like, dang, Penix would be an upgrade and a great security policy for them or whatever. And one of them was the Miami Dolphins. And I said, look, Penix could elevate the Dolphins over Tua if he was able to give like a bridge year or whatever. And like, again, we thought Tua was going to retire like 2 years ago, whatever, like all that other stuff. And people came for me and they thought I was crazy, whatever. He's not a first round pick, maybe in the third round. You watch the tape, dude. Like, watch the tape. Watch what we watched on Pocket Presence. Watch the breakdown we did. Penix is a top 10 talent. Like, and obviously a multi-billion-dollar organization thought the same damn thing. And the biggest thing that I saw in this was, do they need him now? No. Do they think that a guy of his caliber is going to come out in the next few years that they like love, like they loved him? And do they think they're going to have a top 10 pick in the next few years that warrants getting a quarterback of his caliber? This was not picking Penix because he was the 8th best player or whatever. Like that was not what this was about. The Falcons are looking at this like, look, Kirk Cousins is going to be our guy this year. Maybe not next year. Who knows? Like, he's already had an injury. Kirk Cousins has not really finished many seasons healthy entirely. And Penix is that guy. And for me, the way that I look at it, was it a reach? Maybe. Are they going to have a top 10 pick in the next 3 to 4 years? I don't think so. I think the Falcons are going to roll. I think they're going to be really damn good. They have a star team. Kirk Cousins is going to win them a lot of games. They might not have a top 20 pick next year. Like, that would not shock me. And so then you look at the next element of this, which I think people don't realize how much this matters. You know who was lurking not that far underneath of them, pick-wise? The New Orleans Saints. And the New Orleans Saints were very much in a position where they could have taken a quarterback, because if you're going to take a quarterback to sit behind Kirk Cousins, you're for damn sure going to pick one to sit behind Derek Carr and potentially take his job. They know what they're doing. They know what they're dealing with. And at the end of the day, this is a quarterback-driven league. But you need guys around you. You need to give guys time. You need to have a team ready for these quarterbacks. And look, man, you got a bunch of these guys, these young stud receiver, tight end, running back, all in their rookie deals. Penix is going to catch up and he's going to be on his rookie deal while these guys are coming into their own. And look, man, Kirk Cousins, he's never won the big game. I think he can lead them really far. I think they could win a Super Bowl with him, but look at it, dude. Carson Wentz led his team to a Super Bowl and didn't have a job after that because another guy was better for them in that situation. Like, all that Penix needs is a little bit of time, just a little bit of time, and get caught up to the NFL scheme. But he can make all the NFL throws. He can process. He's also a super athlete. He didn't even have to use it in college because he was a super processor and was pinpoint accurate. But like, his game is going to translate to the NFL so well. And every single person that was a part of this decision saw that when they took him at 8, and they were fired up about taking him at 8. Like, that's how highly they thought of him, to think that some other team was going to be right there ready to take him. And look, like, Spencer Rattler was just taken with the Saints, right? Like, not that far after. What was it? What round was it? Third round?
He was a later round guy. Yeah.
Fifth round?
Yeah, it might have been.
I don't even know. But Spencer Rattler was taken. And at the end of the day, like, the Saints are going to be looking to replace Derek Carr. They're not winning it all with Derek Carr. They know that. They've seen it. The Raiders have seen that. Like, we know what Derek Carr is. When he plays well, he's pretty good, but he's not him. And the Falcons feel like they got a guy that has it. And in a division much like the AFC South, the NFC South is ripe for the taking. So go secure that for a really long time. I think, I don't know, maybe it was a Packers, some Packers guy. If you only have one quarterback, you have no quarterbacks type of deal. Like, you need to have a stable. It's been the Packers way for a really long time. They've never had much of an overlap ever with unsure times. And I don't know, man, you look at all these coaches that lose their jobs. Most of them lose their jobs because they don't have a quarterback. So
yeah,
the Falcons, that was a job security decision, and they're going
to
be good for it.
And they cited the Packers as like a model that they were looking to replicate drafting Penix. I think what a lot of people would be critical of is the fact that they took him so high. It seemed like, I mean, I'm not even sure if Penix would have been the next guy to go off the board. We don't know how the Saints felt about him. I hadn't heard that thought that the Saints were looking to draft a QB. Maybe they would have. Maybe it would have been McCarthy or Nix or Penix. Like, all those guys went around the same time. Then the obvious one is how old Penix is, but I think it's less about his age because we see quarterbacks now play into their 40s. I think it's more about the fact that if Kirk plays for two more years, it's kind of like around where people think he's going to play for the Falcons, they could drop him after that.
Yeah.
Penix is now going to be coming into this like weird time in his contract where they might have to extend him. They might not have to extend them. But even as I explained that, that is exactly what the Packers did. And after 1 year of Jordan Love, they realized he was good enough to where now he's going to get a pretty big extension here in the offseason. Yep. So I don't know. Maybe I'm selling myself on it. I was surprised. And maybe that surprise was just, maybe my disapproval of the pick came more from surprise than it came from thinking it's actually not a good pick, because I hadn't thought of an in-division rival maybe coming up and grabbing that guy. And so it's as much of an offensive move as it is defensive against the Saints getting a quarterback.
Yeah, I didn't. I think like, you just look at Geno Smith is such a great example of, he's like what, 30? He's like in his young 30s.
He's like 34. Yeah.
He played when he was like 20, like young 20s, and then didn't play for like 8 years. Like, legitimately did not play. 8 years is a whole career for people. And now he's playing, got a big contract. Like, the way the NFL game is played, you do not need a young quarterback. They're not like running backs. They get better with age. They get better with the right experience. You can taint a guy, though. Like, you can ruin him by throwing him into the fire and developing bad habits and all these other things. The best thing you can do for a quarterback is to let him sit, no matter who it is. Aaron Rodgers would not be who he is today if he didn't sit behind Brett Favre for all that time. That's a fact. Jordan Love wouldn't be who he is today if he did not sit behind Aaron Rodgers. That's a fact. Like, all of these guys that, like, really, like, you feel like they had that little bit of extra, most of them, it came from sitting and learning. And that's why I love CJ Stroud so much. He didn't have to do that. He was able to come in, but he played the game in a way that, like, he played that way in college. And that's my biggest problem with a lot of people. When you watch their film, how did they play the college game? Do they play it to the college level and take advantage of it in a college way? Or do they play it as if it would translate to the NFL? CJ Stroud played the college game like an NFL quarterback. McCarthy played it most likely like an NFL quarterback. Penix played like an NFL quarterback. He did not take advantage of like the scramble opportunities and like the wider hashes as often. Like Penix could have had an even better career with a better scheme, like especially with the receivers he had. So I'm like, that's what I like to see when I see guys and how they play. And I like, Penix is only going to be better when he does hit the field because of sitting behind Kirk Cousins. And that's a fact. That does not hurt him. And so if you take that argument into account, age does not matter.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Yeah,
not for him.
Yeah, the big theme of this conversation, whether it be Drake May, you brought up CJ Stroud, Michael Penix, is that if the pick works out, if the quarterback is good, nobody's going to care about where they were selected in the first round, who was sitting behind them. Like, a good quarterback papers over all of that. And I think some quarterbacks have more of an uphill battle. We talked about Drake May; he got nothing around him, so it's probably going to be much harder for him to get to that level. But if he's good, he's going to make the team much better. His impact's going to be much greater than a good wide receiver or a good offensive tackle. And we're not even going to think about how, you know, they used a third overall pick on him and not got a, you know, Marvin Harrison Jr.
Exactly.
Or something like
the
that.
The number doesn't matter.
The number will not matter if he works out. And that's what they're banking on. Yep. If they liked him that much, they don't care what people are saying about him.
You don't want to miss your guy. Like, you do not want to miss your guy. If you like a guy, you're going to reach for him because you don't want to miss him. And it doesn't, like, reach is a relative term. Like, it's not even like a real thing. Like, these are all humans that are like, can I get this human or can I not? It's not like, well, could get him. Like, it's not really like that. And I mean, yeah, you look at the Packers. Like, I'm pretty sure the Packers wanted Cooper DeJean, ends up going to the Eagles, and they jump in front, like, what, by two picks or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, could the Eagles have only went up one or two, or like, would the Packers even take him? You don't know. The Eagles, they got their guy. they wanted their guy. They didn't care. He was available. They had a trade offer. They went and got him. And so, like, at the end of the day, it's not always about ranking guys and like where they rate on the list. It's like, take all these guys off the list. Let me go grab people. Who do I like? I like him. I like him. I like him. Are they available? Yes. Like, it's not necessarily a numbers game.
Yeah. You brought up the Packers. I probably called this on a prior episode. I certainly talked about it with my friend. I think the reason Packer fans don't get as excited about the draft as other teams is, one, we're never picking very high. And two, we're always going to draft some versatile offensive lineman who can play any position. You didn't really know about him in college, but he's probably going to end up being an all pro in 3 years. And that seems to be what happened. Jordan Morgan, a guy that can play inside and outside. We take him in the first round, get a little linebacker help in the second round. And I get the sense that Packer fans are pretty happy with the draft, but it is a pretty stock Packers draft where it's a bunch of the, I'll call them boring, but they're just non-skill position players. And half of them end up being pretty good.
You know, like, the way that I look at it is, this has worked for a long time, and this is NFC North football. So you just gotta, love it. You gotta accept it. And it is what it is. And if you look at it, like, look at the teams in the NFC North and how they play, and like, what makes them solid teams. The O-line for the Lions is disgusting, and they've been building that thing for 5 years. And now they're flipping to the defensive side, trying to build the line. In the NFC North, you've got to build it from the ground up. You can have a star-studded receiver, you can have a star-studded running back, but if you don't have a line, you can't really get away with it in the North, because the style of football, it just is what it is. And the games that you play outside, they just are what they are. And it's harder to throw, it's harder to run, it's harder to do all those things in the cold in December when it matters in crunch time. Look at the Dolphins. Like, the Dolphins looked like, if you looked at the Dolphins when they played the Chiefs in the playoffs versus some of their games they had in the season, you will have never seen a more polar opposite team ever. And that's what these NFC teams see, these NFC North teams see. And I love it, dude. Like, and also being a part of the conversations of O-line depth chart wise, I realized how much versatile players matter. And I realized how much that matters to the 53-man roster, because some teams will be able to keep less guys on the 53 and allow you to keep more guys in the receiving room because you have one or two linemen that can play multiple positions. Mm. When I was with the Falcons, we kept a lot of linemen because we didn't have as many guys that were versatile, which allowed us to not keep as many running backs or as many receivers. So this game of numbers, like, that's real with roster development. And that's why these guys are worth so much, because, like, do you only need to carry 10 O-linemen? Do you only need to carry 9 O-linemen on the 53? Like, that opens up a return man, like a guy that can be really dynamic and change the game at receiver. Like, and with the way that the Packers receiving core is, dude, if any one of those like bottom barrel guys ends up on practice squad, they're gone. They're going to get taken from someone else. And so I'm going to give them a little bit more credit in this pick of, like, that's their kind of guy, because versatility means more depth and more space to maneuver things that are going to be hard conversations to be had down the line. So,
yeah. Is there like a soft skill or something that's non-tangible? Obviously there's all these measurables scouts look for, but in your experience, like, is there a prototypical Green Bay Packer type of first round draft pick that they want to sit you down in the room and they want to hear this from you, or they want you to be this kind of person?
Yeah, I think the thing with the Packers in the first round, from what I've realized, and look, they've taken a lot of Georgia guys in the first round in the last few years. It's been a theme for them. They want to know what your floor is, and that it's a safe floor. And I think in the first round, where the Packers typically draft is like in the 20s, right? Like, that's kind of been their thing. You want a guy with a floor that can play right away and contribute to the team. Anything over that is a positive, because people do miss on first round picks. And I think the Packers picking safe guys that come from a place like Georgia, come from a place like Alabama, that, you know, they're playing a certain brand of football, there's just this learning curve that's typically expedited because it's as close to real NFL football as you can get. And that just is what it is. So there's like this checked box of knowing that this guy can at least plug in and in 3 to 4 years be a rotational guy, if that's the worst thing that happens. Because there's nothing worse than getting a first round pick that just can't play at all. And they're not going to risk that. So that's kind of what it seems like to me their standard is.
Yeah, a lot of something interesting that I pull out of this year's draft coverage, listening to guys like Todd McShay, is that most of the time teams don't have 32 players graded as first round selections. In most years' drafts, there are anywhere from 15 to 20 first round talents, which means that for the teams picking 20 and above, which, like we talked about, is where the Packers are always picking, is probably a guy that really is a second round talent, but we've just run out of guys that are quote unquote first round talents. And so I think, like you said, they're probably looking for high floor guys where they know they're going to be spending money on the guy. So they don't want it to be, they don't want him to be a complete bust and off the team in 3 years.
Yeah. 100%. Like it. And at the end of the day, if you're picking top 10, that's where you're going to get the higher floor guys with large ceilings. But like, it does get harder. And then it's like, you don't want to pick just based on need. So you want to take best available. Like you, that's a Packers way. Like when we talked to Brandon, the scout, like they take best available. That's their thing. Mm-hmm. And so for them, like best available plus versatility, you just get to check more boxes and it just becomes a safer pick. And that's how you don't, a lot about the draft, dude, in my opinion, is like, how do you not mess it up? Like, how do you build your team and add value and get guys that can contribute to your locker room? Because at the end of the day, you have 53 people on the team. You have like 15 to whatever, 16 practice squad players. You're bringing in new guys that are going to contribute like 20% of your team, like total depth chart wise. But like, you still have 80% of the team that's there, that's been there, that like these guys have to like kind of get in with and learn the flow with. So as much as like player fit, personality fit matters, scheme fit matters, like there's nothing worse than getting a guy in the locker room that just, you're like, dude, this guy doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And cultures in different locker rooms are different.
Yeah. You mentioned Cooper DeJean. He fell into the second round. The Eagles then hopped the Packers. Looked like Packers would probably pick him up. If he fell to him, didn't end up happening. The Eagles did an overhaul of their cornerback room, drafting Quinyon Mitchell in the first round and then Cooper DeJean in the second round. I'm curious.
Yeah.
When you
nailed it.
Yeah. Do you think, how do you feel about it?
I love it, dude. I had Cooper DeJean as a first round talent. I had obviously their other corner as a first round talent. Like what they sucked at this year more than anything was defense, player wise. And they sucked offensively scheme wise. So it seems like they fixed their offensive scheme. We'll actually find out, but defense, they needed all the help they could get. And you get a guy like Cooper DeJean, man, I look at him like a Harrison Smith on steroids. Harrison Smith with a lot of juice. Harrison Smith with can go all over the field. Some Tyler Webb would call him our Jackie Robinson.
I saw a tweet that said that, and I sent it to producer Roddy and might have taken credit for it in the moment. But I will put it, it's funny, but
yeah,
I wasn't Will putting Compton's that into
just,
him.
Yeah. Just so happy.
Yeah, Will Compton, yeah, creamed his jeans a little bit on the pick. But
yeah, yeah. So very, like, I think they really nailed it, dude. Like, again, they had to go heavy defense and Cowboys, like, what are the Cowboys going to be this year? Like, I'm looking at that NFC East, dude. I'm like, Eagles and Commanders are my teams that I put my preseason, like, I mean, I don't even know what their odds are at right now to win the division, but like, I would definitely like to know what is the chances of making a playoffs for the Eagles and Commanders odds wise. Cause I think this is the year that the Cowboys might actually just flop regular season.
Totally.
Again, I think that Dak Prescott's going to have a good year. I think that CeeDee Lamb's going to have a good year, but like they're the team that got the least better out of all these teams in the offseason. It seemed like they didn't even try this offseason.
Right.
And in typical Jerry Jones fashion, we got everything we need here. Okay.
Yeah.
As everyone else around you gets better.
No, I mean, it's exactly it. I think that'll be an interesting conference to watch because each team seems like they could be so volatile. Like you could see the Eagles riding the ship, but they also, they finished last year so horribly. So you could see them, you know, coming out the gate super slow. Same thing with the Cowboys. Totally. I think they have a really high ceiling when everything's firing on all cylinders, but their floor has to be one of the lowest in that division. So you could see any team going any direction.
Yeah, dude. And then you look at like the Giants, defense last year forced the most turnovers, I believe, out of anyone in the league,
right,
or something like that. Like the Giants defense was him, dude. The Giants dog walked the Packers before the Packers went on a playoff run.
Yeah.
Wildly enough, like, and I know people hate on Daniel Jones all the time. When Daniel Jones doesn't play like shit, they're a good team.
Yeah.
And they have a good defense. And that's like one of those annoying teams to play with a weird recipe of how they win games. It's kind of like the Falcons a little bit of last year. But I don't know, man. If I'm a betting man, which I am, if there's one just like North Star of weird feeling, it's like that the Cowboys actually don't find a way to be as good in the regular season as they have been. And you got to think the last time the Cowboys walked on a football field, what did it look like and who was it against?
Yeah.
And did they get better since then? No.
Yeah.
They haven't. So I don't know, man. It's the Eagles division to take this year with the sneaky Commanders, in my opinion.
I like that. I want to jump over to the NFC North soon, but let's talk Chargers really quickly. They pick up Joe Alt. Seemed like the Jim Harbaugh bet your life on it pick. They were going to go just kind of bruiser, dripless offensive lineman that will probably be an all pro for them for the next 10 years. The criticism now is that Justin Herbert doesn't really have anyone to throw it to. They got that kid out of TCU that can't catch the ball. Quentin Johnson, I think, is their number one option right now. So, like, what do you make of this situation for Justin Herbert? Do you think there's a direction they're headed, or might this take a couple years to spin up?
This might take a couple years. And like, that's the thing that bothers me the most is for Justin Herbert, he's going to show up, he's going to play his heart out, and he's going to make 50 plus million a year doing it happily. And like, it just might, this is the same situation that I feel like Philip Rivers got stuck in where like, you're going to ball out, you're going to do your thing. Justin Herbert might actually rival Dan Marino's career. Like, just throwing for a lot of yards, doing the best with whatever he has. But like, was he truly ever set up for success? And it's just one of those things, man. Like, people talk about Herbert, like, is he elite? Is he not? Some people love him. Some people hate him. I think he's amazing. I feel bad for him that he's stuck in LA. And I think that Harbaugh is going to do a good job. I just think that years pass by and good work takes time. And now here you have Herbert, years already in the making, not having ever been set up for success. And Harbaugh can't just come in and flip the switch and set him up for success. You need guys. And that's the number one thing I learned about the NFL. Coaches need guys. And if they don't have guys, it doesn't matter how good of a coach you are. You can only get people to where they are physically and mentally. And that team doesn't have it. And not to mention, dude, like, you keep looking at all these teams around the league. What did they do to get better? I love the Joe Alt pick. Absolutely love it. You need that. But you needed five first round draft picks this draft to make a difference this year. And you, I don't know. I don't know how they do it. I don't know what, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a pretty story. The Chiefs are still there. The Raiders are there and they got better. And I'm actually more excited to watch the Raiders with Gardner Minshew than I am the Chargers with Herbert, because if you asked Herbert in a, this is, I'll say it this way. If you were to ask Justin Herbert in a closed room that this would never get out, would he be happy to be playing with the Chargers with the team that he has? Or would he rather be somewhere else that was more set up for success, like Tua in Miami, or like some of these other guys, or like Caleb Williams in Chicago? What would Herbert rather have? I guarantee you he would not want to be there. And that's just closed door talk. Like, I promise you, he does not feel like he's set up for success. No one in their right minds would think that.
Which is so crazy, because
that's the clip.
I feel like a couple of years ago, they were the dark horse team. They were everyone's pick. Herbert was ascending. They had great skill position guys around them. And then it just all went off a cliff. And then you get into this like hard reset. And I think there are a couple of comps that you can do. We've talked about this Chicago cycle. I don't think they'll be that dysfunctional. I think Harbaugh will. Talk about a high floor. I think Harbaugh will get them to a certain point where he's not getting canned after 3 years, but you do run into this issue where you're now having to rebuild around a young quarterback. And it's, does he want to go through that? Are you wasting time? There were rumors that they could maybe trade him to Minnesota to get a bunch of draft capital in return and just do a hard reset. And so you're in this like really uncomfortable middle ground. And I completely agree. I think if given truth serum, he would probably admit, yeah, I'd just rather be competing for championships right now and not be sitting around waiting for a wide receiver to throw to.
Yeah, I mean, look at Mahomes' situation versus Herbert's. Like, it's just human nature of like, would he feel like he's actually set up for success in his career? Like, you can't tell me with a straight face that he would say yes. Yeah.
And that's the like, Mahomes effect. I mean, that's just like same way Tom Brady did it in the AFC East for all those years, preventing really good quarterbacks in any division from winning Super Bowls. Like, that's just going to be what Patrick Mahomes does. He's like, in his conference, 100%. Coaches are going to run through, quarterbacks are going to run through on an attempt to chase him down. And you feel like Herbert could be that guy, but he just seems like so far behind the eight ball right now.
Dude. Yeah. Like, it's like, if you look at it this way, look at Caleb Williams. No number one overall pick has ever walked into a situation as good as Caleb Williams is walking into. They inherited that number one overall pick from a really bad team. the Bears were not a bad team last year. They just didn't have it together. They didn't have enough offensive firepower. Their defense was really damn good. As a quarterback, the number one thing you want is a good O-line and a good defense. And then, yeah, you want your receivers, but like you need a good O-line and you need a good defense, because at the end of the day, you don't want to get in shootouts every single week. Like, yes, that can be fun, but that's not a sustainable style of play. The Bears have a good defense. They have a solid enough O-line, and now they have skill positions out the ass. If you flip-flopped and put Justin Herbert on the Bears right now, would the Bears be Super Bowl favorites? Like, they'd probably be up there. They'd probably skyrocket. Yeah. Like, and that's just, some guys get into situations as a rookie and some guys don't. And then some guys are stuck in that for years and it just is what it is. And then the next thing you know, their careers go by and it's like, damn, what could have been?
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of the NFL.
It is, I mean, Justin Herbert is the biggest what if quarterback. I think that more than the critiques of his play, I think the critique around Justin Herbert is all of his fanboys that love to say, like, if he had this guy or if he was in this situation, he would be doing, you know, like in a hypothetical world, Justin Herbert is the best quarterback of all time. And I think there is some truth to that. I think it just gets taken to such a crazy extreme. Well,
I mean, dude, you look at Tua. Tua is having a great resurgence of his career. But if Tua had to play for the New England Patriots from day one, he probably wouldn't even be in the NFL anymore. And that's just like, that's how this stuff happens, dude. Not to say that he wouldn't be in the NFL anymore, but like he'd be on a new team, just like Mac Jones. Like, Tua wasn't going to save them. Like, I don't know anybody that would have saved them. Patrick Mahomes would have given him a fighting chance. Like, Josh Allen probably could have ran some people over and like got them to 8-8 or something, or 8-9. But like, it's quarterback play is so situational, and it's frustrating as a viewer of the game to see a guy with such talent not be supported roster wise.
Yeah. Let's talk about the NFC North, which, by the way, you talk about this hard nose run at you football, outdoor cold weather becoming less and less like that. The Bears now have this stadium plan that's going to be a dome, which will make Lambeau Field the only outdoor stadium in the NFC North, which I hope turns that, you know, Lambeau Field into even more of a home field advantage, where now you get guys that will come up and like they will not have played in the cold unless they play in Green Bay. I know that's something that seems to be lost with the Packers these last couple of years, but I'd love to get back to that, especially with this dome being built in Chicago. But regardless, Caleb Williams, Rome Odunze, this new look Bears team, what do you make of it? Right now, I'm getting a little sick of Chicago fans online. I'll say that.
This is the first year that I've looked at Chicago where all their fans are saying this is our year and been like, you got a point. Like, this is the only time I've ever felt that way. Mm. And Odunze is a problem. Caleb Williams in that offense will be a problem. And their defense is really good. And so if you go to Chicago or they come through and you're caught lacking, as long as they're on their shit that day, I think that they could beat anybody, because look at them across the board and look at what they were missing last year. Like, they definitely addressed what they were missing, and strategically they addressed it without having to reach for people. Like, they didn't, like, the quarterback fell in their lap, number one overall pick. A top five player in this draft fell to them at number nine or whatever with Rome Odunze. Like Rome Odunze, in my opinion, was fourth or fifth best player in this draft. And then you add Keenan Allen in the offseason. And what did you suck at? Third downs. Like, they've strategically kind of did their thing a little bit. But again, they play in one of the toughest divisions in football. So like, they're going to have to show up, and it's going to come down to this rookie quarterback. And can he process, can he elevate them in a way that is not playing like a rookie? If he plays like a rookie this year, they'll be a middle of the run team. If he does not play like a rookie, if he has a CJ Stroud type of year, like, they could be a real problem, dude.
Could you explain what you mean by that when you say play like a rookie?
Yeah, like, if it takes him 4 to 8 games to, like, get into a rhythm and get into a flow where he's consistently playing good red zone football, good third down football, like, winning the turnover battle, like there's going to, like, there are rookie mistakes that people make that, for some reason, CJ Stroud just did not last year, that every rookie quarterback goes through, because they think they can be a superhero, where in the NFL, a lot of it's like damage control as a quarterback and then making the plays in the key situations. Look at Mahomes last year. Mahomes had a really bad stretch of football midway through where he sucked. He did not look like himself because he was trying to do too much. Then late in the year, he was so patient throughout the games, the way he navigated them. He waited. He was willing to punt. And then, hey, critical situation, I need to take my shot. And he did, and he delivered. Instead of trying to take your shot in the first or second quarter when, like, you don't need to. And that changes the momentum of the game. So, like, can Caleb Williams pick and choose when to be Superman? And can he pick and choose when to just be a processor in the system at the right times? That will determine their first 8 weeks of the season and set them up for the rest of the year.
I want you to put this into context for us. We talked about the situation that Drake May comes into, Jaden Daniels comes into. I feel like, and this is coming from the perspective of a Bears hater, so take it with a grain of salt, but I feel like the conversation we had around how bad the coaching was last year for the Bears was alleviated in like this weird stretch of three games where they were either competitive or won a few games with Justin Fields. And then all of a sudden we forget that Matt Eberflus was almost getting fired halfway through the season. And they didn't make the Caleb Williams hype seems to have overshadowed the fact that Bears fans seem to have wanted Eberflus fired for a Jim Harbaugh this offseason. That didn't happen. They pivoted their attention to Caleb Williams, and now they seem like Super Bowl favorites in Chicago. But I feel like he's not coming into the best situation. Like, he's a talented player, no doubt. They have great skill players on offense. They have a great defense, but there's still this huge question mark around coaching that nobody seems to want to address, especially in Chicago. So could you explain to us why the situation might be great for him, why it might not be so good? Again, I'm fully admitting that I'm a hater of Chicago, but I just feel like it's going under discussed.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I look at Chicago is like they shot themselves in the foot so many times last year with abysmal play that like they were capable of way more. And so I think that they did not put the offensive struggles enough on the head coach, where it is the head coach's job to like make sure that everything goes, but they loved his defensive essence enough to keep him around. And like, this is the final straw. So could you see Eberflus fired in the first 8 games? Yeah. Could you see him signing a long-term deal at the end of the season? Yeah. Like, this is everything for them this year. And depending on how this year goes, dude, like, we're either never going to hear the end of it from Chicago Bears fans, or we're going to have the last laugh as Packers faithful, and we're about to find out. Like, I will say, on paper, roster to roster, they have a really good roster. And so it's going to come down to coaching and who can outcoach who can set up different situations. And like, you look at the Lions, dude, like Ben Johnson saying, that was huge for them. Like, that would have been a massive loss, the way that he schemes things up and sets things up weeks in advance. And in divisional games, that's what it takes. Like, you've got to be three steps ahead. And it doesn't look like Chicago's been able to do that part.
Yeah, you could almost see it turning to a similar situation to Atlanta, where it seems like the GM in Atlanta is really highly revered. And I think similar, I mean, pulls like a career-defining move to pull off that trade, which landed them DJ Moore and Caleb Williams. Like, I think he's now revered as like, okay, this guy's good at his job. But with Atlanta, it was always, is it the coaching, the play calling? Like, there was this weird disconnect between the players were good, you know, the personnel, the team building was good, but then for some reason, the coaching wasn't good. And then you see them be this mediocre team year in, year out. And that's in a mediocre division. Yeah. I could see the same thing happening in Chicago, where the team building's good, the personnel is really good, but for some reason, the coaching just isn't clicking. And then you're sputtering like 8-8, 8-9. And I think selfishly, as a Packers fan, that's the best thing that could happen. Like, if they were
totally
awful, they get rid of the coach and probably get the right guy in. If they're really good, then obviously that probably means the Packers aren't as good as they could be. But if they're average, they probably just keep kicking the can down the road because they can't figure out who the real problem is.
Dude, transparently, the only thing that the Bears need right now is offense. If Eberflus does what he did last year on defense and they figure out offense, like, they need a Ben Johnson. They need their new OC to show up like Ben Johnson did for the Lions. And at the end of the day, if they don't get that, it's going to be another long year. But I would say there's, for some reason, I don't know why in the NFL it feels like it's so hard for some of these offensive coordinators to get their shit together and come up with a game plan that's their own mind thought instead of just what they've learned from previous coordinators passed down generation to generation. But when you get these guys that have like a real knack for play calling, setting things up, like seeing things on film and being able to replicate them in your own terminology, own language, like at the right place, right time, like, that's how the Dolphins flipped their organization. That's how the Texans flipped it. That's like, how the 49ers slipped. The 49ers sucked ass 8 years ago or whatever it was. Like, really early on, they sucked. And now they're this powerhouse. And you need offensive consistency. And then when you pair that with good defense, you have something. So the Bears offense, dude, like, I don't know. They've got to figure it out this year on offense, or you're going to have to go the other route and get an offensive-minded head coach, because at the end of the day, that's how you sustain in this league. Like, yeah, you can have good defenses and you can win championships with that, like, once in a while or whatever, but like, to have sustained organizational success, you do need offenses that are clicking year in and year out.
Yeah. JJ McCarthy goes to Minnesota. Maybe it's the disposition of Vikings fans versus Bear fans. I live in Minnesota, and I can tell you that Vikings fans have this, they have this nihilism to them where they just assume the worst thing is going to happen at all times, which can be frustrating because you want to talk shit. You want to be like, oh, you suck. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, we just knew the worst thing was going to happen anyway. Whereas Bear fans, I think, are a little bit more posturing and confident. But regardless, I think what isn't being talked about is the fact that you could probably make the argument that the situation JJ McCarthy is coming into is better than the situation that Caleb Williams is coming into. And therefore, I think the Vikings could be the surprise team of the NFC North this year, and maybe not the Chicago Bears. But what do you think of this fit of JJ in Minnesota in the first place?
Yeah, I think JJ is a great fit in Minnesota. The only thing that I have a problem with in this pick is I don't know how much of an upgrade he is to Sam Darnold, with the, like, weighing the fact that Sam Darnold has a lot of experience and can fit in right away. Like JJ McCarthy, I think, is a really good quarterback, but Minnesota has other needs, and it's kind of like, I don't see JJ McCarthy's upside as the same as Penix's upside, to see where, like, the Falcons took him. They're like, ah, we're gatekeeping the Saints. We're taking him because we want him to be our guy. We have a really old quarterback. Like, I don't think that Sam Darnold's that much, like, different today. So if this is an investment in JJ McCarthy for the next 10, 15 years, if that's what you're seeing him as, that's one thing. But today, you're in a division that has the Lions, who went to the NFC Championship, the Packers, who were a game away, the Bears, who definitely have a way better roster than you. Is JJ McCarthy going to move the needle as much as somebody else does with Sam Darnold? Like, what if you had taken somebody else that is a stud at that spot? Would Sam Darnold be a better player than JJ McCarthy will for you? Like, that's kind of how I like to view it. So I think it's a great fit if you take Sam Darnold out of the equation, but you were able to get Sam Darnold for a really cheap contract and you had a top 15 pick. You could have went somewhere else with it for this year, but people just love taking quarterbacks, dude, and they love taking them all the time. And
we are trying to get to the number one Sam Darnold podcast. I don't think there's anybody that's pushing the Sam Darnold agenda more than we are, which I'm okay with. I don't hate the guy, except he's on the Vikings, but whatever.
Like, Sam Darnold is, like, Nick Mullins threw for 300-something yards to Justin Jefferson multiple times last year. Like, he threw for 300 yards and Justin Jefferson popped off. Sam Darnold is leagues out of Nick Mullins, he's leagues ahead of him in terms of talent and what he can do with the football. Like, the Vikings are going to be fine. Like, they might not win a lot of games, but they're going to put up points on offense, and they have a good host. Like, their head coach, who calls their plays, stellar. Like, they're going to be fine on offense. So, like, I don't think you need JJ McCarthy. Like, what you needed was some defensive players. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, holy shit.
No, I get it. But I think you could also take your same logic with the Penix pick and say, hey, we're going to take our guy here. And it seems a little different because it seems like JJ could start right away. But the same logic would be
Sam Darnold's only 26.
If you love Sam Darnold that much, which I know you do, you could make the argument that they're not going to be picking this high ever again. It's a deep quarterback class. Let's take our guy, have him sit behind Sam Darnold, and then we have our guy going forward. And I think that logic probably plays out better here because McCarthy's younger. Yeah. I don't know how you feel about his ceiling compared to Penix's, but I think he's probably higher.
Dude, same I could logic. See Sam Darnold this year having like a Baker Mayfield year where it's like,
let's go.
And then like, holy shit, okay, like let's go sign him to a big deal. Maybe it's not with them because they have JJ, but like, at the end of the year, if like the Vikings are 9-8 and they just missed the playoffs, but like Sam Darnold wasn't their problem because their defense let up 50 points a game, Sam Darnold's going to get paid somewhere next year. And if that's the case, you know what I mean? Like, if Sam Darnold has a year, he's not going to stick around in Minnesota unless they're going to pay him. And then you're going to let a good thing go. Like, I always try to think of these things in terms of like a year or two ahead, not what like in the moment feels good because you want to sell JJ McCarthy jerseys to your fan base and like,
right,
your stadium, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
But that part is...
This is a worse situation than the Falcons, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay. That part is important, too. Like, having some direction. I think it's just harder to sell Sam Darnold to your fan base. And there also is this unknown Justin Jefferson part of the equation. And I don't know where... Has he signed his extension yet? That was sort of up in the air.
I'm not sure.
I think he was going to wait to see what they did at quarterback to sign his extension. And yeah. I think it's just a harder story to tell Jefferson or your fan base, like, hey, we're going to roll with Sam Darnold. I know we're big supporters of him here on this podcast. Yeah. People forget he's only 26 years old. But at the same time, you do have to sell tickets. You do have to sell jerseys. You do have to make sure your best player sits around or stays around. And maybe J.J. McCarthy is the better story to tell there.
Yeah. And yeah, we can move on from this.
Okay.
I love J.J. McCarthy. It'd be the same thing. Like, if J.J. McCarthy went to the Giants, like, is that what the Giants needed? No. Like, is it what the Vikings needed? No. Like, and you also have to think, I'll say this one more thing. You have Sam Darnold here, and, like, he could pop off and really be a guy for you. If you signed him for $10 million a year, you thought you got a deal and you might have your guy. And then, just because we have this pick, we're going to take a quarterback. Where, what about next year? What if you suck this year? What are the chances that the Vikings are not the worst team in the division this year?
I think
they're probably going to be the worst team in the division.
They could be, yeah.
You're probably going to be picking top 10 again. You're going to be picking top 10 next year. You're going to have a better pick next year. Is there not going to be some like sexy quarterback option next year that you're like, you know what I mean? And also you have to think of like the free agent process. Like, good quarterbacks are free agents every year. Like, there are always options at quarterback, in my opinion, to where if you're not like 100% this is our guy, or this is 100% our guy for the future, like, they must think he's the guy for the future, because if not, that's a wasted pick.
Dude, why not just run the Packers pipeline back? Let's just get Aaron Rodgers in here. They're going to need a vet to come in. I mean, the funniest joke was the Vikings seem like they're a quarterback away, and they let the guy walk that could be a good plug and play option. So let's just get Aaron Rodgers back in here and complete time as a flat circle and complete the whole process. Okay. Let's run through a couple other big news items here. I'm curious on your thoughts here. The Chiefs got the fastest player in combine history. Yeah. I feel like historically drafting the fastest guy, I'm looking at you, John Ross, has not worked out for teams. However, it seems like people think that it's just going to work out because it's the Chiefs. What is the argument?
It's going to work out.
It's going to work out? Okay, fine.
It's going to work out. Great. You got Big Red designing plays for this guy. Like, it's the same thing we talked about with Hollywood. Like, how do they use guys? The Chiefs use receivers different than other guys, and they will get him open. And they will get him open in space. You look at the space that these guys have in all the routes that they catch when they're on these deep crossers and overs and, like, posts and stuff. Same thing with Tyreek. Tyreek is, in my opinion, one of the best receivers in NFL history. If Tyreek had not gone to the Chiefs to start his career, he may not even have gotten an opportunity to show his full vastness of a skill set, because he would have been stuck in a box in a West Coast scheme running four or five routes, right? Like, Andy Reid wants to win football games and he loves being creative, and you have a gunslinger in Mahomes that will deliver. Like, nothing, this spot could not have been better for him as a receiver. He will be able to maximize who he is as a receiver here. And that just is what it is. It's going to work as long as he can stay healthy.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the most inevitable thing, it feels like, where this guy ran this super fast 40. We're all like, oh, the Chiefs could get him. And then they end up getting him via a trade with the Bills. And they got raked over the coals. I feel like that's unfair to say that the Bills just gave him this guy, but it maybe is a little bit more fair when the Bills also needed a wide receiver, but they ended up picking up Keon Coleman, and it was a deep wide receiver draft.
Keon Coleman is a dog. Like, the Bills getting Keon Coleman, I love that. He was actually, I had him mocked there in one of my early drafts. His style of play is going to thrive not only in Buffalo, not only with Josh Allen, but like with the way that they play football. Like, that is going to work. And dude, he's one of the guys that can do things out of this draft class that other guys cannot do. The way he can climb the ladder, the way he can snag it, he feels like I'm watching a mix between Brandon Marshall meets like who we all thought Kelvin Benjamin was going to be. Like, Keon Coleman, I really think, has it. So for him to go here, to have Josh Allen as his quarterback, to have tight ends that also can stretch vertical, like, he's going to be a really good scheme fit. I think they're going to use him well. I'm excited to see what their offense looks like this year, first and foremost. I hope they take some things from around the league that other people are doing with ease and implement it. But Keon Coleman could be a problem, and I'm really excited to see how that plays out.
I love it. Speaking of another rookie wide receiver, sort of an offbeat story, but one I want your opinion on. Marvin Harrison Jr. has not signed his NFLPA licensing agreement. So basically what this means is that once players get drafted, they need to sign their rights to the NFL Players Association so that they can have their jerseys made, they can have trading cards made, they can get in Madden. Players usually sign this. It's just some free money up front, and it's something that most players do. But Marvin Harrison Jr. is holding out. I have some information we can go through, Kurt, but I just want you to peel back the curtain a little bit for us as to why he might be doing this. You know, what the benefit is. Is he missing out on a lot of money?
He probably is not missing out on a lot of money marginally at this point, considering what he's probably already made in college. And most college players sign this because they've come from college with no money. And so this is a nice upfront bump. Like for me, when I was in college coming out in the NFL, I signed a deal with Panini, and I think I made $80,000 signing rookie cards. I had to sign 20,000 rookie cards.
Oh my God.
So it was in two batches. It was a lot of, some of them were on the cards, a lot of them were slips, but basically how it worked was I had 10,000 cards that I had to sign at $4 a pop. That was the first part of my deal. And this price per sign was negotiated based on where they believed you'd be picked up, what market you might go to, team, whatever. And so like I was heavily incentivized to get that deal done because I had no money to my name. I was getting paid from my agency like a living stipend, but I had made no money in college. I was coming out with nothing. Like I needed to make NFL money or I was going to have to get a job. And so these deals with cards and stuff are typically signed early so that you can get some money in your pocket to give you some cushion until you get your first NFL paycheck. So for me, $40,000 in my first 10,000, and then they re-upped again for the second and completed my deal. I signed 20,000 slips for $80,000. For me, that's great at that time. And you look at Marvin Harrison, when you come out of college with many millions of dollars, and these are the types of deals that are coming, maybe he's getting $20 a signature. Who knows, right? Like could be making $500,000 signing 20,000 cards or 50,000, who knows what it is. When you've already made many millions and you have the leverage because you don't have to say yes, the ball's in your court to do what you want. And I'd imagine that he's probably fighting for an amended agreement that he gets a bigger percentage or a bigger whatever, that he feels he actually brings more value back to this NFLPA operation than they're bringing to him. So
sure,
that's probably from a far look or from looking from the outside in, that's kind of how I see it.
I think something interesting about this that I read is that now that NIL is allowed, and I think you're exactly right, where these players are coming out and they're getting paid anyway. And so we saw this with Caleb Williams, where he didn't sign an agent because he knew pretty confidently he's going to be drafted first overall. He had so much money that he's earned through NIL that he didn't need that living stipend from an agency because he knew where he was going to get drafted. There's no negotiation in his rookie contract. He can save himself the 20% agent fee and just sign with an agent on his next contract when he looks to renegotiate. Marvin Harrison Jr., I believe, did the same thing. But another interesting part is now since NIL is allowed, these high profile college players are signing likeness deals with companies like Fanatics in college. And the way it works, the way that Fanatics gets a good deal out of it, is that they sign a likeness deal with a player like Marvin Harrison Jr. that carries them through their second year in the NFL. It's typically a two-year deal. And so during those first 2 years of Marvin Harrison's NFL career, theoretically, he'd be getting a discounted rate from Fanatics or from those autograph signings than what he would be getting if he had hit the open market as a top five draft pick. And so what he did, pretty smart, and it's probably with help from his dad who's gone through this before, he said, I'm not signing anything in college. So there was no Marvin Harrison Jr. jerseys you could have bought in college, which is fine. He's probably missing out on, like you said, a marginal amount of money. But when he hits the NFL, his rate is now set as an NFL rate, and it's not this discounted rate he's playing through for college. And I think what's especially smart about it is he's now able to break it out. So whereas players are getting checks cut to them based on what the NFLPA's agreement is with all the NFL's vendors, Marvin Harrison Jr. is now going to each vendor individually and saying,
direct by source,
and saying, here's what I want my rate to be. So he's signed a $1 million deal with Fanatics, which has to be more than any rookie and probably most players are generating, especially in their first two years. He has a deal for autographs. He has a deal for other like marketing sponsorship opportunities. And so he's going company by company and probably demanding a higher rate at each, then bundling it all together with the NFLPA. So I think it's savvy. I think it's smart. I think the downside would be he currently can't be in Madden because he doesn't have his likeness signed over to the NFL. So there might be some like branding cap that's put on this, but I'd imagine once he gets his money from each of these individual sources, he'll probably say, okay, now it makes sense for me to go to the NFLPA and collect this smaller lump sum so that I can be a part of the league, you know, the league likeness and branding initiatives. But I mean, for him, he's getting his money early. And I think you see a lot of players do that now that they have the ability to do it starting in college.
Well, especially with like the way that social media works, like the way that the NFL industry works with social media and getting paid and all that stuff is way different than traditional like solopreneur social media operations. And a lot of guys in the NFL don't use social media the way that like a lot of like that others do. And I think the way that like the business of sports is going, you're going to have these top guys who are already just crushing it with their name, image, like just they are celebrities before they're ever like stars in the NFL. They're going to have their deals that are different than the crop of guys that are lumped into the NFLPA operation of like, you're in Madden, you're going to get your $20,000 Madden check this year, but also you're going to pay us $20,000 of our NFLPA cut. So it's going to be like negligible. We're going to handle all of your insurance and all of your other stuff and like all of your like paperwork and like there's like fees and dues and stuff. So you're looking at him as like, it's the same thing. Like if I wanted to go broker a deal for myself using my YouTube, using whatever, Instagram, whatever, like as Kurt Benkert, the non-football player, I would make more money from a Fanatics deal than I would as Kurt Benkert, the practice squad quarterback, or Kurt Benkert, the second string quarterback on an NFL team that's lumped into this NFLPA deal that's just being brokered as a mass deal. Like, and that just is what it is. And it's funny. It kind of reminds me of the Packers in a sense. When I was with the Packers in 2021, I was doing a lot on social media at the same time as playing, and it just kind of was like a weird thing started going in one way as I was also still on the team. And so I started getting inquiries for deals to leverage like on TikTok and YouTube, all that other stuff. And one of them in particular was with Quick Trip, the gas station Quick Trip.
Yes.
And I didn't find out until after the deal was done that Quick Trip already had a sponsorship with the Packers, that they do sponsored activations with the Packers, like with them as like an organization, as a company. And they would bring in players like Rashawn Gary to do a Quick Trip segment or like whatever. And they'd get paid like a little stipend to do it or whatever. Like that was like marketing dollars going to the Packers. And it was handled there. Where for me, the Packers didn't even know that I had a Quick Trip deal, because Quick Trip came to me as the individual and said, hey, we love your TikTok. We want to collab. We want to do some stuff together. And I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was like $15,000. There's a deal. I think it was $15,000 for a couple of videos that like, if I had had it funneled through the Packers, I would have never gotten that deal. Like I was not a guy, but they came to me directly because I was reaching their target audience through the videos that I was making, regardless of me being a football player with the Packers. Like it did not matter that I did not play on the field to them. They loved the reach and the target audience and like all the behind the scenes on when you're doing marketing on social media. So that's my best example of what Marvin Harrison is doing on a mass scale, way bigger scale than what I was doing. But it's like, look, dude, how much value does he bring to Fanatics? Way more than what the NFLPA deems his percentage of being an NFL player does. Marvin Harrison, the social media influencer, the this, that, the other, would have his own deal with Fanatics if he wasn't in the NFL, if he wanted to do his own thing. Like it's just different. And it's two different funnels of business. And you're going to see that get really hairy over these next 5 to 10 years with players. And that's why we believe the NCAA is going to dissolve. Like,
yeah.
Do people need them anymore? Like it's the same, like people are realizing, just like anything else in the business world, in the personal world, in the sports world, that a lot of these entities and things that are set up for specific reasons, there's automation to handle those things now. There's resources to do it yourself. You don't actually need these big hierarchical structures to get things done. And I don't know. I feel like the veil has been ripped off a little bit, and it's only going to continue to be ripped off in this world of social media influencing. Mm-hmm. Why are dollars being spent? It's to get a message in front of an audience. Who has the audience captured? The social medias of these players, which are getting millions and millions of views more than just sometimes the games are. So yeah.
I think we're already
both sides are important.
I agree. And I think we're already seeing this impact play out in the draft. Like this bridge between NIL and the NFL specifically is going to be so interesting. So this year, only 58 underclass players entered the 2024 draft, which is the lowest since 2011, I believe. And a lot of that reason is because college players can now make money while still in college. And it's, I mean, you play college football. It's probably a pretty sweet life to be big man on campus, stay in school another year.
I would have made more money in college my senior year, like at this rate of NIL stuff, than I would have on practice squad in the NFL. And it just is what it is. And so like, if I was going back and doing it in this time period, stay in college as long as you can. Be that guy as long as you can. Gain more experience. There's nothing bad that can happen besides an injury. Like, that's the one risk. But you can also get injured in the NFL. You could also just get to an NFL team and the coach gets fired. And then they don't care about you. Like, there's a lot of unknown and risk. So, like one in the hand worth two in the bush. Like, stay in the hand with what you got. Keep earning. Keep growing. Keep building your following. Build whatever. And it'll all shake out when it needs to.
Yeah, I think you made an interesting point, too, when it comes to these players doing their own thing. I feel like that the toothpaste is already out of the tube when it comes to college football. I think these individual players are making so much money that there are efforts to unionize college football players and to set up a sort of players union the same way that every major sports league does, which has immense benefits. And I'm so glad, and as I'm sure you are, like, that the NFL has a players union, however strong it is compared to other sports leagues. It's been a net positive for players as they've had to bargain throughout, you know, the history of the league. But for college players, it seems like some of these players are making so much money on their own that they realize joining a union would probably hurt their earning potential. And for that reason,
100%.
There's going to be more people advocating.
And
against it.
For that reason, I'm out.
For that reason, we're out. Kurt, but we're back on weekly uploads. We'll be back here maybe all summer. We'll see what we can cook up this summer. I just got the feeling the other day. I'm like, I cannot wait for football season.
Dude,
I'm so excited.
I can feel it. Like, the summer's going to be good. We're going to have good stuff going out. But man, by the time we hit the season, we have so much cooking. It's going to be a lot of fun. Can't wait to share with everybody that listens regularly. Those of you that are new, hang out with us. Keep rocking with us. We got a lot of good things on the way. And Tyler, it was good talking, man. Glad to be back.